Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson, along with Sarah Williams.
Vietnam blames China for the sinking of a boat in disputed waters.
U.S. President Barack Obama says Washington supports Southeast Asian nations as they negotiate territorial disputes with China.
More than 50 people are sentenced in Xinjiang for several offenses, including terrorism.
Our roundtable examines the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown.
And the last princess of China's Qing dynasty dies in Beijing. Hello and welcome to China Focus.
Let's look at some of the biggest news stories this week.
After weeks of collisions between Chinese and Vietnamese fishing boats in a disputed area of the South China Sea, a Vietnamese boat sank on Tuesday. Shannon Van Sant reports China and Vietnam blame each other for the incident, with China asserting the Vietnamese boat was in Chinese waters.
Authorities said collisions Tuesday between Chinese and Vietnamese fishing vessels caused the sinking of a Vietnamese boat in the South China Sea, 30 kilometers from a Chinese oil rig based in contested waters. China's foreign ministry says Vietnam is to blame for the incident. Foreign Ministry spokesman Qin Gang says a Vietnamese fishing boat forcefully intruded in the area of China's oil rig and capsized after ramming a Chinese boat. He said Vietnam's dangerous actions were the direct cause of this incident, and China urges Vietnam to safeguard normal navigation and fishing activities on the sea. Vietnam says 40 Chinese fishing boats encircled and rammed a Vietnamese boat, causing it to sink. All 10 fishermen on the Vietnamese boat were rescued. Vietnam says the $1 billion Chinese oil rig is in its exclusive economic zone. China claims nearly all of the South China Sea and maintains the rig is in its territorial waters. China also announced the cancellation of some flights to Vietnam as tensions between the two countries continue to rise. During the past few weeks, violent protests in Vietnam against the oil rig resulted in the deaths of Chinese workers and looting of Chinese factories and businesses. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
U.S. President Barack Obama mentioned tensions in the South China Sea during a foreign policy address Wednesday at the U.S. Military Academy. He said that American isolationism is not an option, but not every problem has a military solution. Mr. Obama also referred to cyber attacks, which the U.S. has blamed on five members of China's military.
We have a serious problem with cyber attacks, which is why we're working to shape and enforce rules of the road to secure our networks and our citizens. In the Asia Pacific, we're supporting Southeast Asian nations as they negotiate a code of conduct with China on maritime disputes in the South China Sea. And we're working to resolve these disputes through international law.
This week, authorities in a turbulent part of western China held a rally in a stadium for the public sentencing of 55 people found guilty of a range of charges, including terrorism. At least three defendants were sentenced to death. Others were sent to prison for murder, separatism, or other charges, such as joining groups considered terrorist.
Police announced at the rally in Xinjiang province that they have arrested another 65 people on similar charges. The official Xinhua news agency said a crowd of about 7,000 witnessed the sentencing Tuesday in northern Yili Prefecture.
VOA correspondent Fred Wang in Urumqi, Xinjiang's capital, says the mass sentencing had echoes of darker days from China's past.
All those guys were put on the orange prisoners' clothes and put on the car to parade something. So that's a very bad idea. We only saw that in the during the Cultural Revolution times or days of those old days, but not now.
Beijing announced a year-long security crackdown after following an attack in Urumqi last week that killed 43 people and wounded more than 90 others.
I asked Fred Wang in Urumqi to describe the heightened security.
You can feel the security forces everywhere. There is armed vehicles just in our intersection. And when I entered to the hotel, which I'm living in right now, there is the two armed guard policemen with the bulletproof jacket and with the shield
and all kind of things. They checked everybody for their bags, what's inside in their bags, and you can see a group of the special policemen in their black uniform, like a SWAT team, pass by. As soon as you are inside the city, you can you have the kind of feeling, of chilling feeling, that some car somewhere is going to have something is going to happen.
Have you been able to get over to the area of the market where there was that the bombing last week?
I went there several times, and the cars, the person, not to say the foreign reporters, were stopped. You are not going to get in anywhere nearby. There were three entrances to the places where explosion and the tragedy happened, all blocked by the policemen. There's from the outside, I can see the whole lot of police cars, armored vehicles, all those things in the street. Still, no entrance at all.
Fred Wong, VOA reporter in Urumqi, the capital of the troubled Xinjiang province.
We're glad you could join us for China Focus, heard every Friday on the Voice of America, and you can download our program anytime you like from our website at voanews.com/China Focus. Still to come, a roundtable discussion on the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. In the run-up to the 25th anniversary of the violent Tiananmen Square crackdown on democracy protesters, China's State Council this week issued a white paper describing what it sees as progress in improving human rights. The study says the government has effectively safeguarded its citizens' right to life and health, personal liberty, personal dignity, and other rights of the individual.
Citing the abolition of the re-education through labor camp system last year and efforts to combat human trafficking, the report says China has been effective in protecting the rights of women and children.
This week, the rights group Amnesty International lashed out at Chinese President Xi Jinping for what it calls the widespread persecution of activists ahead of next week's Tiananmen Square anniversary. It says dozens of activists have been detained and placed under house arrest or questioned by police in recent weeks.
The rights group says among those detained are rights lawyer Pu Jincheng and journalist Gao Yu, while the spokesperson for the group, Tiananmen Mothers, Ding Zilin, has been placed under house arrest.
Maya Wong, a Hong Kong-based researcher for Human Rights Watch, talks with VOA's Victor Beatty about the current rights struggles in China.
I think that there are certainly a trend of using more criminal detentions, using kind of public order charges. Though I think the use of political crimes, there are still the use of political crimes as well. It's a little bit hard to see if one goes up and then the other goes down. It seems that Joy Hua's statistics suggest that. But I think there is certainly an increase of public order charges.
Why are Chinese authorities doing this? Is it to lessen the high profile of some of these cases so that they don't get international condemnation?
I think partly that might be the case, because to charge somebody with inciting subversion, that is quite clearly a political crime that is targeting somebody's expression. So it attracts a lot of international and domestic attention. But charging somebody of a public order charge is so much more vague. And what comes to mind is often people who might have provoked, a fight on the street or something. So it also seems to be kind of smearing the activists themselves. But at the same time, I think the charge is probably a deliberate act by the government, because it's so vague that any kind of behavior by an activist could be considered a crime under this very vague definition. So Pu Zhixiang went to a private commemorative activity for the Tiananmen massacre, and for that he was detained for creating a disturbance. So I think the crime is also convenient for the authorities to just put anybody it doesn't like in detention, because the crime is so vague and is being expanded to include all kinds of behaviors, peaceful behaviors.
Maya Wong, Human Rights Watch researcher who's based in Hong Kong. You're listening to China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, one of China's most beautiful cities has a new ambassador for tourism. Here on China Focus, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown and its significance.
We begin by speaking with two prominent China scholars, Andrew Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia University, and Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California, Irvine.
I started out by asking Professor Nathan how Chinese university students in 1989 created such a huge protest.
Well, they were tapping in, I think, to a lot of long-buried feelings on the parts of students and other residents of Beijing and other cities around the country. So the students didn't really organize much, but once they started showing up asking for a fight against corruption and rehabilitation of the leader who had just passed away, Hu Yaobang, not his rehabilitation, but his memory to be honored, and for what they called democracy, then a lot of people came pouring out to support those ideas.
And looking back at this, Dr. Wasserstrom, was this really a kind of an amazing signal event that this could have happened like this amid a very repressive government?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary event. I mean, it didn't come out of nowhere. I wasn't in China in 89, but I was there in 1986 and 87 academic year, and there was a wave of protests then, and that grew quite large in cities such as Shanghai, and then were tamped down quite quickly. But the grievances didn't go away. As Professor Nathan described, there were just a lot of simmering causes of discontent, some of which built up in the period between 86 and 89. There was high inflation in 1988. There were a mix of economic concerns, a desire to have the benefits from economic reforms spread more widely, and just a disgust at what was felt as too much power and too much arbitrary power and too many benefits from reforms going to a small cluster of people and their kith and kin, which, of course, is still a simmering cause of discontent in China now, anger at corruption and nepotism.
The build-up to the events on June 4th, which is what many of us tend to focus on, took quite a long time, months, in fact, and the actual occupation of Tiananmen Square was several weeks. The government took quite a long time before it moved to crack down and clear out the square. And I'll begin with you, Professor Nathan. Why did the government take so long to take action?
They were divided. They couldn't decide what to do. So on the one side were some liberals in the top leadership headed by Zhao Ziyang, who was the leader of the Chinese Communist Party, who thought that the students were making demands that were appropriate and they converged with what the party itself wanted to do. And he thought that the leadership could handle it by telling the students that what they wanted was okay and that the party would go ahead and do that. And then on the other side, there was a conservative group in the leadership that thought that if they didn't crack down, that it was really the end of Communist Party leadership because that leadership depends on a monopoly of power. So they debated this back and forth, and both factions had to go to Deng Xiaoping, who didn't occupy any official position but was the leader behind the scenes, and all of the younger leaders had agreed in advance that if there was a critical issue, Deng would decide. And Deng didn't really want to get involved at first and tended to support Zhao Ziyang because he was the senior leader. But when Li Peng went to Deng Xiaoping and said, the students are actually naming you and calling for your downfall, Deng was angry about that and felt that this really was a threat to the model of rule and that the students were bad people. So he said, we've got to take harsh measures. And then they took a series of harsh measures, first an editorial threatening the students, basically, and then when that didn't work, declaring martial law. When that didn't work, then finally making the decision to use force and clear the square.
Professor Wasserstrom, would you like to add to that?
Well, I think one thing that's significant looking back is that the fact that there was a crackdown wasn't really what seemed so surprising at the time. What seemed surprising was how long it took for the government to take decisive actions. And I think that division at the top is a key part of things. And I think Professor Nathan hit on some very important things. One is that in a lot of ways the protests were simply calling on the Communist Party to live up to its own professed ideals. And there could be some resonance of that among Communist Party officials at the time. But there was also the kind of awkwardness that Gorbachev was coming to China for a very high-profile meeting with Deng Xiaoping and other leaders. And so I think there was probably a hope on the part of the leadership that this would just fizzle out, that this would dissipate. And then there was also a hope, I think, when they brought out this harsh editorial April 26th condemning the protesters and saying that the protesters were creating turmoil, a kind of code word for the kind of chaos that was associated with the Cultural Revolution period that nobody really wanted to go back to, that the protesters would just leave. But in fact, that editorial just angered a lot of people who saw what was going on in the streets, not as turmoil and chaos, but as simple demands for change that were acceptable. And so a series of moves that the government made that they thought would tamp down the protests actually served to rev them up. So there were a variety of factors going on there.
The government in Beijing moved very quickly to distance itself from the events of June 4th. In fact, pretty much try to erase that from the public memory. And one of the amazing outcomes of the events then is that they were highly successful in doing so. The subject is so taboo that nobody can speak about it. There's virtually no discussion about it. And a lot of people don't even know about it who were born after 1989. Professor Wasserstrom, if the government had moved to give some of these fringe concessions to the general public as an outcome of Tiananmen, why is the government still so fearful of what happened that day?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I do think the whole phenomenon of this effort to put a state of amnesia on the event. I mean, I do think that the giving in for some things and the trying to change people's focus is part of what goes along with that effort to bring about forgetting. I mean, there are people including younger Chinese, certainly who know that something happened then. Some of them know a fair amount about what happened, despite all the efforts to keep control of the flow of information. Some have gone to Hong Kong or they've gone to the West and they've heard about it. But part of the idea is what the Communist Party also keep saying is, look how far we've come. Look at how strong China is in the world. Look at the booming economy. Look at the spectacle of the Olympics. And I think it goes along with the forced amnesia because it's an effort to keep people distracted and focusing on different things so that even if they get an inkling of the messiness that the government was involved with, that maybe this will discourage them from pushing too hard, trying too hard to find out more.
Professor Nathan, your thoughts on the legacy of 1989?
The Chinese regime has maintained itself up until now and has prospered economically, but I still feel as though the Chinese regime, although it's strong and economically prosperous, isn't the last word for China. It just, we were talking about it earlier, the regime itself feels very insecure.
Any thoughts on just that last point, Professor Wasserstrom?
I don't think we should write off by any means the desire for change. I mean, I think it's been surprising, and Professor Nathan has been one of the people who's described this really well, this authoritarian resiliency, the way in which it's adapted and things. But it hasn't solved the fundamental problems, the fundamental threats to its legitimacy. The desire to change things has never disappeared from within China, and the lack of confidence, despite all the things that the country has accomplished materially, the Communist Party still, as shown by the repression of the memory of 89, is still fundamentally insecure in many ways. So I think those are all important things to keep in mind going forward.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California, Irvine, and Andrew Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia University. The Japanese newspaper Minichi reports that the last princess of China's Qing dynasty died Monday at a Beijing hospital. The 95-year-old Kenki Ashinkakura was born in Lushan, now known as Dalian. She was the younger sister of Yoshiko Kawashima, who was known as the Eastern Matahari and later executed for spying for Japan in World War II.
Ashinkakura went to school in Japan, and she worked at the Beijing office of a Japanese textile company at the conclusion of the war. She was arrested in 1958, charged with spying, and served 15 years in prison. She spent a further 7 years at a correctional farm, and in 1979, her honor was officially restored.
Ashinkakura opened a Japanese language school near Beijing and published an autobiography, Born as a Princess of Qing Dynasty, Living Between Japan and China. Sounds like quite a book.
It certainly does. Well, the Chinese city of Hangzhou has appointed a foreign tourism ambassador. Liam Bates, who has a British father and American mother, kind of like me, grew up in the United Kingdom and Switzerland and attended a Canadian university. He now lives in Beijing.
The 26-year-old Bates gets a free 19-day trip to Hangzhou and a 40,000 euro salary for telling the world about the city using a variety of mediums, including social media. The Hangzhou Tourism Commission calls this the Modern Marco Polo Experience Program, of course named after the legendary Italian explorer who visited the city back in the 13th century.
And I know, Jim, that's one of your favorite cities in China.
Indeed. I've enjoyed visiting it many times.
In other news, a new tourism poll says Beijing is near the bottom only after Moscow in a ranking of transport and friendliness. TripAdvisor says the Chinese capital's locals are not helpful. The taxi drivers are not friendly, and its taxi services are poor.
I could never tell because they were always speaking Mandarin. However, the Japanese capital of Tokyo is ranked in the same poll as the best destination. That city was praised for its local public transportation, hospitality, and the cleanliness of its streets. Jing Daily's Twitter feed this week included a survey that says China's affluent are becoming increasingly focused on experiences through travel rather than material possessions. A new survey by MasterCard of over 1,000 affluent individuals from countries across Asia, including China, found that the tendency to seek and discover authentic experiences, as opposed to purchasing and owning physical luxury items, is growing stronger among China's rich. When asked about their most desired experiences, Chinese respondents listed activities in the travel, dining, and other categories before retail. Travel is the most popular experience for China's wealthy, according to the survey, with 32% of respondents stating it's their top passion. Whether you'd like to tell us your own travel stories or comment on our program, you may. We'd like to hear from you. You could email us at voaasia@voanews.com. And, of course, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Sarah's handle is at VOA Williams. I'm at VOA Stevenson.
Next week, we'll continue our look at the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. That's it for our show. I'm Sarah Williams.
And I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to China Focus.